Hello and welcome. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for the first in a series of three CMEO snacks titled Guiding Lights, Managing Developmental Epileptic Encephalopathies with a Closer Look at Lennox-Gastaut Syndrome. The CMEO snack series is supported by an independent medical education grant from Jazz Pharmaceuticals. I'm Elizabeth Teal. I'm Director of Pediatric Epilepsy Program at the Mass General Hospital in Boston, where we have a comprehensive epilepsy program treating many children and young adults with DEEs. And today I'm joined by Dr. Bethany Thomas. Dr. Thomas, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you. Hello. My name is Bethany Thomas. I'm an epilepsy nurse practitioner at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania in our Comprehensive Epilepsy Center. I also am the lead nurse practitioner for the Department of Neurology here at Penn Medicine. And in my clinical role, I treat adults and young adults with epilepsy.
Well, thank you, Dr. Thomas. So to frame the discussion today, let me review our first learning objective. Our goal is that after this CME snack, you will be able to identify the impact of DEEs on patients and their families across the whole lifespan, including challenges associated with initial diagnostic delay, as well as disparities in care. Here are definitions for abbreviations you may see throughout the activity, mainly for our medications, as well as some of the disorders that we'll be discussing. Dr. Thomas, DEEs include both developmental and epileptiform components. What are some of these different causes that come together in DEEs? And then could you also go into some of the impact that this may have on the patient as well as the family?
Absolutely. You can see here listed on the slide that both developmental encephalopathies and epileptic encephalopathies can be included in DEEs. And essentially, this means that there can be genetic causes or other intellectual disabilities that contribute to any developmental delay without any coexisting epilepsy or epileptiform activity. Whereas you can also have epileptic encephalopathies that are cognitive impairments that are directly due to epileptiform or seizure activity. People may revert to near their normal baseline cognitive state with intervention or in between seizures. And the impairment is not necessarily always present prior to the seizure onset, as is the case in LGS, Dravet, and others. And as we move into the next slide, you can see that the impact of these DEEs impact not only the patient in many different areas of their lives, but also their caregivers. So you can see listed along the top, both of these encephalopathies contribute to physical functioning, child's development and sleep. There can certainly be epileptic seizures. Behavior is a big problem or issue for both patients and caregivers, and also various degrees of cognitive impairment. And when I think of DEEs, I really think of this along a spectrum. So for every patient, they have an individual experience where some of these may be more impacted or impactful to their overall daily lives than others. Looking at the caregivers' health-related quality of life, obviously, in many of these patients with DEEs, both children, young adults, and adults, the parents or caregivers end up heavily into a caregiver role. And so all of these different aspects can really impact their daily lives, needing to provide both physical ongoing care. They're unable to oftentimes perform their own activities of daily living, caring for themselves, a lot of emotional well-being. And these impacts can have detrimental effects on the caregivers. A lot of psychosocial impacts, not being able to work, not being able to maintain their finances, having to work reduced hours oftentimes by caring for the patient. A lot of times there are social impacts for both the patient, certainly, and their family and caregivers, and a lot of emotional impacts. This can impact both interpersonal relationships, issues with their spouse, partners, and the rest of their family. So you can see really through all these different areas, the impact is pretty great, both for the patient, their caregivers, and the whole family.
Yeah, no, and I agree. And I think this has been a big transition in our approach to care of these patients. When I was a resident, we treated seizures. You know, we didn't really think about the impact of the possible epileptiform activity on the patient. And we really didn't have a focus on the impact of the disorder on the whole family and not just the patient. So I think this has been a great improvement in our approach to management of people living with DEEs. So then kind of looking at the next slide, and I think we all realize that there's often a delay in the diagnosis, particularly of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. And when this has been looked at, the delay can be anywhere from 2 to 15 years before a patient actually receives the diagnosis, even with a much earlier seizure onset. And much of that time may represent valuable time that's lost that could have resulted in better seizure control with the use of indicated treatments and possibly better overall outcomes. And what are some of the reasons behind why the LGS diagnosis can be delayed? And what are some of the ways we can overcome this in practice? You can see kind of from 2 to 15 years is that diagnostic delay, and there can be a delay in the evolution or display of characteristic clinical and EEG features. Children may start having seizures and yet not have the characteristic EEG features of LGS. There can be variable presentation, and EEG features we know also change over time. Unlike some of our genetic epilepsies, there is no single or consistent etiology and not a biomarker to diagnose LGS other than the EEG features. And also the seizures in LGS may go into remission and also may recur. In addition, we've come to realize that rarely there can be late onset LGS, kind of with really developing the classic features in adolescence even. And while LGS is considered a rare disease, we know about 5% of children present with seizures or presenting with seizures may actually have LGS. And as we'll see in this discussion, kind of diagnosing and identifying LGS really has become even more important in order to make these treatments we now have available for patients. So looking at the refractory epilepsy screening tool, I think this has been a great asset, particularly for our adult colleagues who, when they meet patients coming in their office with these seizures, may not have the early history from their childhood, may not have the early EEG, which might have shown the slow spiking wave. So I think this tool is really, really helpful, the refractory epilepsy screening tool for LGS. And kind of as you can see, there's a major criteria looking at the seizure types, this time of seizure onset, the EEG changes, and then cognitive impairment since childhood, and the minor criteria, things that are also frequently seen. So, Dr. Thomas, I don't know how you have found this useful in your practice or your colleagues' practice, but I know many of my colleagues who found that this has been very helpful in identifying adult patients and diagnosing them with LGS.
Absolutely. I think certainly the perspective from the adult epilepsy clinic, we have really found this tool to be very helpful in our clinical practice. Again, acknowledging the fact that this typically was an electroclinical diagnosis that was given based on specific EEG findings, which we now know are not always present in patients specifically as they get older or reach our adult clinic. So like you mentioned, for those patients who we don't have their pediatric EEG history or who their adult EEG is no longer showing those findings, that does not necessarily mean that these patients don't carry a diagnosis of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. So really the purpose of the tool is certainly not to undo any of the diagnostic features or criteria that we typically thought of, but really to broaden the perspective in could this possibly or likely be Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, even if some of the clinical features are now missing from the testing. And so in our adult clinic, I think we use the tool and this possible minor criteria often when we see patients who have medically refractory seizures, who have failed surgical or dietary therapies in addition to that. And certainly with other EEG abnormalities, we see a lot of GPFA or generalized paroxysmal fast activity on EEG and multiple seizure types, and really putting that picture together to ask the question, could this still be LGS even if certain pieces are missing? Now that we know that having a specific diagnosis would help this patient, not only with individualized treatment options, but as well as providing prognosis and guidance to patients and their families. And as we move to the next slide, continuing that idea with certain disparities that are present for both children and youth with epilepsy and Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, we know that children and youth with epilepsy are 3 to 6 times more likely to have other neurodevelopmental or psychological conditions. But the majority of these folks are not receiving mental health care. So a lot of this care then relies on their neurologist who's treating the seizures or epilepsy. Children and youth with epilepsy are more likely to experience premature death. And we see certainly on the adult side that late onset Lennox-Gastaut syndrome is associated with significant cognitive impairments. And this can be quite disabling. And so for a lot of our patients who we see who have cognitive impairment and debilitating seizures and epilepsy who do not carry a LGS diagnosis, oftentimes it's the cognitive impairment that really makes us take a step back and question, do we have the right diagnosis? And so it's in these cases where that REST LGS tool was really developed to help specialists and non-specialists alike. We're really trying to bridge this gap, but we know that 55% of children and youth with epilepsy have low socioeconomic status, 32% reside in rural areas, and 53% of them have public insurance, with majority having low health literacy. So we're really talking about a cohort of patients who may not have appropriate access to care or specialist care, and really trying to make sure that whether or not they're seeing epilepsy specialists, these folks are getting the right targeted treatment that is necessary for patients with LGS.
Yeah, that's why I think it's really important to increase awareness about LGS and the tools to help diagnose it in adults and adolescents, because a lot of these individuals won't have access to epilepsy centers, and so we'll rely on more local neurologists and sometimes even non-neurologists in order to help manage their seizure disorder. And so again, with our improving therapies available, I think being able to diagnose this and help educate our healthcare colleagues as well as the patient community is really important. So let's move on now to our next learning objective, where our goal is to have you to be able to incorporate the latest clinical trial data and real-world evidence for individualizing LGS treatment plans. So LGS pharmacotherapy, we know that there's limited evidence existing for current diagnostic and treatment patterns, and many studies have shown that most patients experience polypharmacy. Recent RCTs have reported that patients had tried up to 18 to 28 medications. So these patients have highly refractory epilepsy with a median of 6 to 8 before study enrollment. And emerging novel therapies that are still under investigation for LGS include ganaxolone, soticlestat, and carisbamate. So looking at the treatment paradigm, I think most of us would consider the first line still valproate. It's been out since the 1970s, well-known medication, one of our older medications with a well-established side effect profile with side effects that we know how to monitor for and manage. And then we also, as second-line therapies, are FDA-approved medications specifically for LGS, including CBD, clobazam, lamotrigine, fenfluramine, rifinamide, and topiramate. There's also evidence for several off-label, including levetiracetam, zonisamide, perampanel, and brevetiracetam. And then we also know that in this patient population, that their non-pharmacological therapies are play a very important role, including dietary therapy with a ketogenic diet, low glycemic index treatment, modified Atkins, as well as neuromodulation with VNS, possibly emerging role for RNS, and for many, depending on etiology and seizure type, callosotomy or resective surgery. And then put here in last, considered last line is felbamate, which in my experience can be very helpful and very efficacious and also very well tolerated. And Dr. Thomas, I don't know if you have other experiences with your use of these medications in this patient population.
I agree with the listing here. I think I agree with your conversation about them as far as the medicines that we typically use. And we oftentimes will use felbamate in this patient population as well, but I think with the side effect risk profile, we think of it later on.
And then going to the next slide, and this is a complicated slide, but I think an important one. We know that while there are many different anti-seizure medications, the adverse event profiles significantly differ, and some therapies may be better suited to patients than others. So we're lucky to be in a position where we have several different treatment options and to look at possible comorbidities that patients might have, either with mood, behavior, cognition, sedation. As you can see here, kind of the down pointing arrows are the medications that we know can have an adverse effect. So it's cognition with topiramate and zonisamide and the other scene. And it's also important to remember that some of our medications can have positive positive effects in addition to improving seizure control, including valproate, finamide, lamotrigine, and cannabidiol for mood psychiatric, and others as shown for sleep, sedation, cognition, et cetera. So again, I think we all approach the management of each patient with LGS independently on what is this patient's features and what are the aspects of each medication that could either benefit them or be detrimental for them. So Dr. Thomas, kind of going to the next slide, can you discuss results from this study that aim to describe the real-world treatment patterns in patients with LGS and DS?
Absolutely. This study really aimed to look at how these folks with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome and Dravet syndrome were being treated. I think some take-home points here, they had a significant number of patients both with both of these diagnoses. 104 patients with LGS and 62 patients with Dravet syndrome were looked at. And across these patients, the first three lines of treatment were levetiracetam and valproate were the most commonly used medications. The thought was that misdiagnosis and delayed diagnosis of Dravet syndrome and LGS were common when looking at this patient cohort. The anti-seizure treatment modification could have been due to inadequate seizure control, potentially resulting in polypharmacy. So if you look at the middle column here, polypharmacy in this patient cohort occurred in over 60% of these patients after first-line treatment. And the most common reason for that additional medicine to be placed on was lack of efficacy. And so I think that what this highlights for me, again, seeing those first two commonly used medications is what we typically think of. But also, this is a patient population with highly refractory seizures and also other medical comorbidities, and they are at high risk of high burden of polypharmacy. And we know that each of these medications can each carry their own individual side effects. So then you get into a place where you're managing multiple different medications, the side effects of each one of those medications. And so having early diagnosis with LGS or Dravet syndrome may enable us to use more targeted therapy and potentially reduce this burden of polypharmacy and overall improving patients' quality of life.
And I agree. And I hope that I think with the increased awareness of Dravet and LGS with the recent trials and with the patient advocacy groups, hopefully the diagnosis will be made earlier and more correctly. I was kind of surprised at this on how many of them had a delayed or misdiagnosed, how many of these patients had a delay in their diagnosis. So hopefully that will be changing. So now we'll take a closer look at clinical trial and real-world data on some of the newer therapies that we have for our patients with LGS. Dr. Thomas, would you mind reviewing rifinamide?
Sure. Rifinamide is a medication that we've been using for many years. It was FDA approved for adjunctive treatment of seizures that are associated with LGS in patients 1 year of age and older. And this is a medication that modulates sodium channels. You can see this analysis here, looking at mean seizure frequency difference when compared to placebo. Common adverse events that we see with rifinamide include vomiting, somnolence, and decreased appetite. And then moving on to the next slide, I'll hand this one back over to you, Dr. Teel, if you can give us an overview and some of the latest data that we have on pharmaceutical grade CBD for LGS.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that as we all know, the pharmaceutical CBD is now FDA approved for the treatment of seizures associated with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, Dravet syndrome, and tuberous sclerosis complex greater than 1 year of age. Lots of proposed different mechanisms of action, but we think it targets neuronal and non-neuronal microglial networks and regulates overall excitability and neuroinflammation. And a complicated figure over to the right shows some of the different mechanisms by which this may take place. And there were several major clinical trials with the pharmaceutical grade CBD, including two in LGS, as well as the open label extension trial that incorporated patients from the earlier two RCTs. In addition, we have now several years of real world evidence on the safety, efficacy, the non-seizure related outcomes, and impact of pharmaceutical CBD on quality of life. The next slide kind of looks at the data from the LGS trials of pharmaceutical grade CBD for LGS, and kind of what you can see on the left is the drop seizure frequency, and the y-axis is the median percent reduction in seizures per 28 days. And you can see both during the randomized control trial, as well as in the open label extension, there is impressive efficacy that is maintained with time. And then looking over the right, the total seizure frequency, so showing an effect of efficacy both on drop seizures, which is the primary endpoint in the study, as well as total seizures in this patient population. The common adverse events and have been very consistent across all the randomized controlled trials with pharmaceutical CBD, as well as real-world experience, are diarrhea, largely in part due to the sesame seed oil formulation, as well as the fact that CBD is a mild laxative, a convulsion, somnolence, and somnolence is often due to drug-drug interactions, particularly with clobazam. And then also identified liver-related adverse events with increased ALT, increased ASTs, and abnormal LFTs. In the clinical trials, the majority of these patients were on concomitant valproate. And important to note that none of these patients met Hy's Law for liver damage. Then looking at the BECOME survey with caregivers with pharmaceutical CBD, and this also is an interesting graph, and the y-axis here is the percentage of responders reporting improvement. As you can see here, this includes those that had a worsening in seizure frequency, no change in seizure frequency, and improvement in seizure frequency. And you can see that even those that had a worsening in seizure frequency, the caregivers thought that there were still improvements in cognition, in language, in emotion, physical, sleep, and ADL, suggesting that aside from efficacy and seizure control, there may be benefits of pharmaceutical CBD. As you can see, those benefits were even greater in those who had improvement in seizure frequency. So this has led to a lot of interest in the epilepsy community on could patients benefit from pharmaceutical CBD in addition to aspects in addition to seizure control. And then looking at long-term safety in the next slide and efficacy, the results from the expanded access program in adult patients. There was an expanded access program with the pharmaceutical CBD that we were a part of. Many people, I think, ended up enrolling over 1,000 patients. And so going looking at those of over 18, so the adults who were enrolled in that. As you can see here, looking at the median percent reduction from baseline in convulsive and total seizures, it's on the y-axis. You can see kind of across all of these periods, there was a significant reduction both in convulsive seizures as well as total seizures. And in this group, similar to before, the main adverse events that were seen in greater than 20% included diarrhea and somnolence. And the liver-related adverse events, again, some increases in ALT, AST, and abnormal liver function tests. Again, important to note that none of these met criteria for Hy's Law. So Dr. Thomas, fenfluramine is the latest FDA-approved therapy we have for LGS. And could you give us an overview on fenfluramine and some of the safety and efficacy data that we have to support its use in LGS?
Absolutely. So first, just a high-level view, fenfluramine, like you mentioned, is now FDA-approved specifically for treatment of seizures associated with Dravet and Lennox-Gastaut syndrome in patients 2 years of age and older. While the exact mechanism of action for this medication is unclear, it likely exhibits dual activity. And if we go to the next slide, we can review some of the safety and efficacy data from the recent clinical trial. This study design included 146 males, 117 females, both children and adult patients who had a Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. The age ranged from 2 to 35 years of age with a median of age 13. These were randomized to placebo group, and then there were two different dose for the fenfluramine that was studied. That was the 0.2 milligram per kilogram per day group and a 0.7 milligram per kilogram per day. So you can see that decrease in the frequency of drop seizure frequency was significant in this study. Looking at concomitant medications, certainly as expected with the Lennox-Gastaut syndrome population, valproate was the most commonly used concomitant medication. There's also, moving to the next slide, looking at a post-marketing study of patients who were treated. This was looking at the duration of their treatment, dosing, and their seizure frequency, improvement in both seizure, cognitive, social, and motor outcomes, and adverse events. And we saw that at 12 months, 89.3% of these patients remained on the fenfluramine. 58% were responders or achieved a sustained 50% reduction in seizure frequency. 10% of the patients experienced seizure freedom. I think importantly, when again looking at those quality of life indicators, we saw cognitive, motor, and social improvement in a majority of these patients. There were cognitive improvements in 70% of these patients. And so again, when thinking of our adult LGS population, where oftentimes the cognitive impairment is the primary dictator of how their quality of life is, I think this is pretty significant. Looking at adverse events, at least one was experienced by 59.7% of these patients, and in 86.5% of those cases, plausibly attributed to the treatment. But notably in this review, there were no cases of pulmonary arterial hypertension or ventricular heart disease. And this was consistent with what was seen in their randomized clinical trials. And then moving on to the next slide, this is a busy slide and really just a high-level overview. This is not currently FDA approved for LGS, and clinical trials are still needed in this specific patient population, but it does have approval now for CDKL5 deficiency disorder and is thought to likely have some efficacy in other refractory epilepsies. So more on this to come.
So I think it's pretty clear from what we've reviewed with these new medications, particularly with the pharmaceutical CBD and fenfluramine, that these have been really great additions to our toolbox for treatment options for our patients with LGS. And I think both the safety and tolerability profiles of both of these medications are favorable, particularly compared to some of our other medicines. So important to have these as options. So finally, with our final learning objective, we'll want you to be able to integrate a collaborative approach to care for patients with LGS using caregiver, patient quality of life assessments, shared decision making, and long-term considerations to improve outcomes. So a recent survey gathered information on caregivers of children with LGS and other drug-resistant epilepsies and their experience with healthcare providers' evaluation of behavior, communication, and quality of life. Dr. Thomas, do you mind walking us through that and then go into some approaches for shared decision making that we could use in practice?
Absolutely, I'm happy to. I think that this is a really important aspect of care of patients with any epileptic encephalopathy, or developmental delay, or refractory epilepsy. I think our priority as treating providers oftentimes is the number of seizures or seizure control. And that's not always the primary goal of the caregiver or the patient. Looking at the whole patient and looking at the impact across all aspects of their life, oftentimes they're more concerned about their behavior or level of engagement, level of consciousness during the day. Sometimes it's polypharmacy. And so I think having more survey instruments like this, where we're able to measure appropriately what is important to the patient, what is important to the caregiver, and make sure that we're incorporating that into our patient discussions when we're seeing them, and making sure that our goals are aligned with both the patient and caregiver goals. And I think that that was highlighted very well in this study, which really looked at caregiver responses and then what was questioning really aspects of how they felt their healthcare provider evaluated the aspects of the care that were important to them. So of the 245 caregivers that responded to this survey, vast majority agreed that their measurement of behavior or communication was really important in evaluating the patient quality of life. But concerningly, less than half of them felt that the encounters that they were having with their healthcare providers were evaluating those aspects of care well. So I think that part of the barriers are certainly a lack of specific tools or surveys to do this. or not having, enough of the time that we have in our clinic to really achieve everything. So we really need to target the time that we have in order to make sure that we're meeting the goals of our care and the patient's needs. And so if we go to the next goal, slide here, looking at shared decision making and the share approach, this was created by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality to help describe the provider role in shared decision making. And this is really looking at, in our patient population, not only our participation with the patients, but also making sure that we're including that caregiver, the family. And again, with the overall aim to make sure that our goals and our treatment decisions are aligned with what their priorities are. So share here, you can see first seeking that participation. And I think this is where surveys or communication tools would be very helpful in helping kind of bridge those gaps in what the priorities are between. Helping to explore and compare treatment options instead of being told one option. Now we know there are several different treatment options for all of the different aspects of care for encephalopathy. So really talking about different ways to treat this, whether that's surgical, medical, dietary therapies. Making sure that we're assessing the values and the preferences of the patients in order to reach that decision. And then an important part is coming back and evaluating the decision that we made. Any kind of medication change, are there side effects to this? Is it effective? I think we do a very good job at adding medications into the mix and maybe not the best job at pulling away medicines that aren't clearly effective. And so making sure that we're minimizing the polytherapy that we provide for our patients. And so I'll keep moving through and really to bookend this to end with a patient case here. This is a case of a patient who has potentially late onset LGS, which represents rare and treatment resistant generalized epilepsy, which is disabling and can oftentimes be associated with progressive cognitive impairment. So this is Ben who's visiting his regular primary care doctor. He's a 34-year-old male. He's developed a new seizure onset at age 18, and that likely has become more intractable. He's averaging 5 seizures per day. He's had several medication trials. He experiences several different seizure types. He has drop seizures, tonic seizures, and generalized tonic-clonic seizures. He's not living independently at this time, really due to progression of his symptoms. He's moved in with his sibling 5 years ago. Currently at this time, he's taking a combination of valproate, topiramate, and then he has diazepam nasal spray as a rescue medicine. Prior to this medication combination, he had tried levetiracetam in the past, and he was last seen by his neurologist 6 months ago. The reason for the primary care encounter today were that he had new seizures, increasingly poorly controlled with the medication regimen, and the rescue medicine was no longer working for abortive therapy. This had happened several months ago and had one trip to the emergency department yesterday, and this provoked the emergency department to have him see his primary care doctor. And so after seeing this patient and administering the REST LGS score, the score was 8, and the primary care doctor recommended to go back and see the neurologist for further investigation of this. Patient goes and has an outpatient or an inpatient video EEG recording. And on that EEG recording for Ben, we saw GPFA or generalized paroxysmal fast activity. And you can see this on the screen here. It's the first arrow. And then also saw the generalized 2 hertz slow spike wave, which is indicated by the second arrow on the screen. These findings are clearly seen in patients who have late onset LGS. So based on this EEG finding, Ben was ultimately diagnosed with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. After asking both the patient, Ben, and his caregiver about his medications, they were able to discuss a need for better seizure control. The priority of both Ben, his family, siblings that he was living with, as well as the neurologist, was to achieve better seizure control while minimizing medication side effects. On further discussion of this with the patient, the family revealed that topiramate might have caused some problems with both Ben's mood and his cognition. And so then the neurologist discussed other options with the patient and their family, and they decided to try rufinamide as another medication option. And now look at one other patient example. This is Rian, who presents to her pediatrician. Rian is a 10-year-old female. She was first diagnosed with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome at age 5 and has developmental delays but can now read at a first grade level. She's also on a combination of medications including valproate and rufinamide. She has midazolam nasal spray as a PRN rescue medicine. The last medicine change that was made was a year ago, and that's when she was switched from daily valproate and levetiracetam to her current regimen of valproate and rufinamide. She has a history of following other medications or products. She had previously failed lamotrigine, topiramate, phenobarbital, rectal diazepam rescue medication, and has also tried over-the-counter CBD and THC gummies. And so Rian is seen today because she has been having more seizures in the past 1 month, with about half of the seizures that she's now having as drop attacks, leaving her at risk for falls. This is an increase from previously having a seizure a week to now having more than one seizure every day. The caregiver discloses that they tried CBD lollipops. They purchased them at a local dispensary in the last month. They seem to help, but not enough, as she's clearly having significant amount of seizures daily. Now, patients may be using these over-the-counter CBD products, so it's really important for us as care providers to convey the message that these over-the-counter CBD products are not studied or approved for seizure indications.
And I think that's a really important point, Dr. Adams. And I think one of the things, I think this has changed over the past 10 years, but initially when patients started using these artisanal or medical marijuana preparations, they often were afraid to tell their care provider that they were using these. And particularly with the known drug-drug interactions of CBD with some of our other anti-seizure medications, I think it's very important for physicians to be aware if our patients are taking those. But I agree with you, and this is a conversation I've had weekly, if not daily, for the past several years, is what is the difference between the pharmaceutical grade CBD we now have versus the products like the gummies and the other products available. So very important kind of to not only know, are patients taking these, what are they taking, but to kind of discuss this with them, what the differences are between what they're taking and the pharmaceutical grade CBD. So then let's pause and so the audience can respond to the following question, and then we'll see how we do. So which of the following is true regarding artisanal CBD products obtained over-the-counter or at a dispensary versus FDA-approved pharmaceutical CBD? And choose all that apply. So as we can see, the correct answers here are B. Artisanal products generally have lower but varying concentrations of CBD than pharmaceutical CBD. And D, artisanal products are loosely regulated and labeling regarding CBD concentration may be false. One of the things I've gained a lot of respect for in kind of my journey in learning more about CBD as a possible therapeutic for epilepsy is cannabis plants are very fickle, and depending on the temperature, the humidity, the soil, the sunlight, the concentration of the different chemicals, including cannabinoids in the plant, can vary significantly. Regarding that second comment about loosely regulated and labeling regarding concentration can be false, the FDA now a couple times have gone to different dispensaries and gotten high CBD, labeled high CBD products and tested, and many of them did not contain the amount of CBD or did not have that concentration. Some did not have CBD at all. So another discussion I have with my patients and their families are to really, without that regulation, and I'm a believer in the FDA process of regulating our medications, looking not only at efficacy, but safety and tolerability. Without that, if my patients are taking these other products, I really don't have any idea what they are taking.
I absolutely agree with you and share the same perspective. Now, moving forward into a team-based approach for management of Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, obviously this is a topic that is near and dear to my heart. As I am a nurse practitioner, I work in a multidisciplinary team in the Epilepsy Center where I work, and we utilize nurse practitioners to improve our access to care for our patients. Obviously, we work hand in hand with our adult neurologists and epileptologists. And so I think broadly, it's really important to acknowledge and value the role that everybody plays in providing optimal care for patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. Certainly, we rely heavily on the primary care doctor, the internist, advanced practice providers, pediatrician, the caregiver plays a role, and then certainly the guidance of the neurologist and epileptologist. In addition to the medical providers that are seen here on the screen, there are also various different specialties and disciplines that are oftentimes needed to provide optimal care for the lifelong medical needs of patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. This may include speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, physiatry, any different subspecialist for any other medical comorbidities. A lot of psychiatry is involved in the care of these patients, as well as other medical subspecialties such as cardiology or gastroenterology. And so having a shared care model here and team-based approach really helps to optimize the care that we provide to these very complex patients. I'll take one side note here and put on my transition of care hat. In my role here, I coordinate the transition of care from our pediatric center into our adult epilepsy center. And I think having this team-based management is really helpful, specifically in the transition of care, making sure that the care that is so well provided on the pediatric side with multidisciplinary specialists is carried over into the adult world. And oftentimes this is a little bit more spread out and not always in the same center, but making sure that we're able to continue this and provide this for the patient as they come over to the adult centers, I think is one of the most important pieces of the transition process.
And I completely agree with you. I think many of us are still working out what is the optimal way to transition our patients. And I think I like this slide because it demonstrates that with these patients, actually with all of our patients, but particularly with our patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, and not only the highly refractory epilepsy they typically have, but all the other issues, I think it's really important to remember we're not just treating seizures, we're taking care of people and their families. And so I think a team approach is really a very valuable and important way to view that care. So then let's summarize with our SMART goals: specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. That is what we hope our audience will take from this presentation to apply to your practice. To recognize that the major impact of DEEs on patients and their caregivers, families, and practice, how cases of delayed or misdiagnosis contributes to poorer outcomes, and how REST LGS may help any practitioner, including specialists and non-specialists. You know, like in the case that we discussed, it was a PCP that used the REST to help determine the patient might have LGS, and that might be able to identify patients that recognize a need for further workup for LGS. Also able to identify how many of our anti-seizure medications may impact patients, and that the potential newer FDA-approved medications and emerging therapies to have real potential to change outcomes and improve quality of life in addition to improving seizure control. Then importantly, very importantly, it's the idea of using multidisciplinary strategies for quality, including quality of life evaluations and care throughout the lifespan to ensure optimal patient outcomes in those living with LGS. And so I'd like these activities and a wide variety of activities and resources on rare diseases like LGS are available on the CME Outfitters Rare Disease Educational Hub. This CMEO snack is also associated with the CMEO briefcase activity. We hope you will also participate in the briefcase to additionally reinforce information learned in this snack and apply it to patient cases. To receive CME CE credit for today's program, complete the post-test and evaluation, and you will be able to download and print your certificate immediately upon completion. Thank you again to Dr. Thomas for joining me today and CMEO for the activity. Thank you to our audience for participating and providing the best care for patients with LGS and their families.